some national policies don't have a lot of support, either from the public or from key decision makers. But our next guest says that doesn't mean those ideas are necessarily wrong. In a recent piece on the Bloomberg website, he makes the case for things like fracking, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and forgiving student loan debt. Noah Smith is a columnist with Bloomberg. He was previously an assistant professor of finance at Stony Brook University. Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey.
Well, what led you into this contrarian article? I assume you're not about to run for office. Why did you decide to tackle five ideas that don't get a lot of love in our political system?
I had just noticed a big disconnect in the sort of Twitter sphere or sphere of public opinion. I noticed a little bit of sort of groupthink and just sort of an intolerance toward, ideas that weren't, consensus. And I thought, I'm just going to poke at the world by thinking of the ideas I can think of that will annoy the most, the conventional wisdom the most,
Well, here's one, and I'll congratulate you on this. You're going to unite the right and left on this one against you. You make the argument for rejoining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, this is one, a lot of people in the Democratic Party didn't like this in the 2016 election. Donald Trump ran against it. Why, given that there's a lot of hate for this on both sides of the political spectrum, why do you make the case that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the smart move?
Well, the main reason that it's a smart move is because it builds a trading bloc centered around the United States that does not include China. The benefit of it is really geopolitical instead of economic. We would benefit a little bit from it economically because it would force open, Japanese markets to our agricultural products and cars, for example. There were going to be some concessions there. But then, we would get a few things. But overall, the economic impact would be relatively minor. It's the geopolitical impact of building this alternative trading bloc that would be a good thing. But I think that a lot of people were fed up with trade deals. They felt that they'd gotten a bad deal on the WTO, a bad deal on NAFTA, and they said, we just want to win. We want to block one trade deal, so let's block this TPP. And they got it. They got their win.
And yeah, a lot of people look at the current trade dispute with China, and some people are saying, well, if only there were this multi-country coalition that could balance out China's trading partner in the Pacific. Do you see this as a missed opportunity, pulling this drive against the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Of course it was a missed opportunity. And I was saying that at the time. Now we have everybody rightfully freaking out. They're like, oh, my God, China can boss around the NBA and make LeBron James say whatever they want LeBron James to say. They can boss around Blizzard, the gaming company, and make them fire whoever they want Blizzard to fire and blah, blah, blah. They can do all these things. And then people are waking up to the idea that China is not a very liberal country. They're putting a million Muslims in concentration camps, crackdown in Hong Kong, et cetera, and surveillance cameras that just measure every piece of your life. And people are saying, well, maybe we ought to have some sort of coalition to balance these guys out instead of going it alone. And I'm like, it was called the TPP, and you canceled it because you were in a bad mood and you're pissed at trade deals.
And in your piece, you say usually you think the public generally gets things right politically. Why did this one and the other ones you're talking about, why do we have exceptions where you think the popular wisdom goes in the wrong direction?
I can't say because, the way that the public forms public opinion is a little beyond me. I've been part of it for a long time, and I've observed it, but I can't yet tell exactly why things break in a certain direction. With the TPP, I think that there were relatively few people who stood to obviously clearly benefit from it, and a lot of people who sort of thought they might lose and felt uncertainty about that, and so it became an easy target. There was no clear constituency for it, where there were a whole lot of constituencies that felt that they should be against it, and I think that was its downfall. But some of these times, I think that just bad ideas turn into memes, and they spread on their own because it fundamentally takes a lot of effort to defeat bad ideas and to debunk them, and eventually we get around to it, but it can take a long time.
Talking to Noah Smith, columnist with Bloomberg, he recently wrote a piece arguing for five ideas that in one way or another, he says, have gotten a bad rap in public opinion, in political sentiment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should we revisit the Trans-Pacific Partnership? What do you think about fracking, student loan debt forgiveness, H-1B visas, and more robots. And let's go there next, Noah. There's a lot of concern that automation, especially in factories, is pushing people out of work. You say, hold on, we may actually benefit from more of it. Why?
Well, first of all, the idea that robots will put humans out of a job en masse may or may not be true in the future. There may come a day when that happens, but that day is not here yet, and it hasn't been here in the past. And there's lots of people.
I'm Ann Strangehams. We interview a lot of writers on.
Sorry about that. No, we had some stray audio there. Pick up your thoughts on automation.
Oh yeah, I mean, so recently in the last couple decades, there has been, no sign that we've had job displacement from automation overall, because maybe people, so suppose that you have an assembly line with 20 people, right? And then you have each person puts on a part of the car. And now you're placed with robots, and you say, okay, we only need 10 people now to work the robots, to work the machines. And the other 10 people, sorry, you're out of a job. But then, because it gets so much cheaper to make cars, more people buy the cars, and some more car factories open, and they say, okay, they take those 10 people who were laid off, and they say, okay, we'll need you for this other plant. So for many, many years, that's exactly what happened. At the larger level, people who get laid off from one kind of job can go to another kind of job. And so it's not really clear. I mean, when we look at companies that do a lot of automation, we see them adding a lot more higher. We see them adding jobs overall. We see them adding higher paid jobs and eliminating lower paid jobs. That looks good. And so this idea that robots are going to just replace us is still science fiction, right? It's still in the realm of something we might need to deal with in the future, but we haven't had to deal with yet. Meanwhile, the countries that have a lot of robots include places like Singapore, Korea, Japan, Denmark, and Germany. Those countries all actually have healthier manufacturing sectors than we do.
Do we measure the health of a manufacturing sector in terms of how much they produce or how many jobs it makes? I think people come at it from two different angles there.
Both. I mean, we've had since around 2000, when China joined the WTO, our total production in manufacturing has flatlined. It hasn't increased. And our total manufacturing employment has fallen off a cliff. But if you look at places like Germany or Korea or Denmark or Japan, they've had a steady decline in the percentages of their populations that work in manufacturing, but they haven't had a big drop off in the number of jobs. So in other words, you haven't seen these big layoffs with manufacturing workers never able to come back to the career they once knew. And that is what we've had. And it's been bad for a lot of people.
We are talking to Noah Smith, Bloomberg columnist, about national policy ideas he knows are unpopular, but he's pushing for anyway. Let's bring on a caller now before we move on to some of our guests' other suggestions. Boyce is with us in La Crosse. Boyce, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in regards to your guest's comments on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and opposition to thereof. Obviously there are a lot of people who are upset with previous trade deals, and that might have accounted for some opposition to it. But there are also a few very pernicious things about that particular trade deal that people who are stakeholders, the members of the public, would have no means of having changed, like its effect on intellectual property and I just felt that he wasn't really doing justice to, why people were opposed to it.
Boyce, thanks a lot for the call. I know you'd mentioned that was one concern people had that might have led to opposition, concerns over the intellectual property aspects of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal.
Right, exactly. And, that was definitely a concern because we have an intellectual property regime in place that is not very good, and this would probably make it a little bit worse. And so that was a bad aspect of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But as soon as we got out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the other countries took it out because they didn't really want it. In fact, the bad IP stuff was actually stuff that only the United States was really pushing for. And so after we got out, they said, well, guess what? The Trans-Pacific Partnership no longer has these IP provisions. They took them all out. And so actually, we should just rejoin without those IP provisions that have now been taken out.
Boys, thanks a lot for the call. We'll bring on a caller on another one of the issues we've talked about. Rick is with us in Rhinelander. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question to your guest is, he had mentioned that he felt automation was net beneficial in terms of employment, and he used Germany as an example. I would counter, or perhaps I should ask his opinion, as to whether that's not a case of the German government having more mercantilist policies than the United States, which since the 1980s has essentially adopted a laissez-faire attitude. And the result of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the statistic is correct, there are more GM employees in China now than there are in the United States. There are still lots of jobs that have been outsourced to Mexico and China because of cheap labor and low environmental standards, but it has precious little to do with automation. It has more to do with policy, and I'd be interested in his opinion on that.
Rick, thanks for the call. What do you think, Noah?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that we allowed China to essentially keep their currency undervalued against ours for about 10 years. We thought that, you know, sort of opening our markets unilaterally to Chinese goods would make them liberalize the way it sort of did for Taiwan and South Korea before China. And it didn't work at all. And China's still not liberal at all. And that gambit failed. And also, we just wanted cheap stuff. And of course, people who wanted to do business in China wanted to make a lot of money. Some of them did. And I agree with the caller. He's right. But now, hopefully, we will correct that mistake. And if we're going to regain competitiveness in manufacturing, one thing we're going to need is a lot of robots.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to columnist Noah Smith. He wrote a piece recently at Bloomberg making the case for five policies that don't get a lot of love from the American public or in the American political system. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Let's tackle another one, Noah. Now, some people love this one. Most people don't like it, it appears, according to polls anyway. The idea of a student debt forgiveness. A lot of people concerned about fairness. You know, back in the day, I paid off my loans. Why should people today get their debt forgiven? What do you think?
Well, I mean, in general, you know, doing that kind of thing, forgiving some people's debt, whereas not doing anything for people who paid off their debt, it is unfair, you know, and I absolutely sympathize with people who say, well, I worked really hard and paid off my debt. Other people didn't. Why should I, you know, get nothing and they get this debt just canceled? So I think any program of debt cancellation should have some kind of benefit for the people who did pay off their debts, so it feels less unfair. But in the end, I think, you know, the biggest concern is just that we're saddling. A whole generation took out loans that they probably shouldn't have taken out, even if there had been no Great Recession, they shouldn't have taken them out. And especially the Great Recession just clobbered people, so they didn't get the kind of job they expected to get, didn't earn as much money as they expected to earn, couldn't pay stuff back. We've got like 50% of student loans in a state of technical default or something like that right now. The government owns all those loans, so it's not like canceling student debt would hurt private industry at all or cause a banking crisis. It would just make the government take on some more debt, which we actually can do because interest rates are super low. And, you know, a whole generation of smart Americans, smart young Americans, is being held back from the opportunity to do things like start their own business, switch jobs, take risks, change careers and things like that. And it's just not optimal for our country. And so while I think we should do things like give money to the people who already paid off their debt as a way of making it more fair, I also think that just for the sake of making our economy more efficient, we need to do something about that student debt.
Right. That's the core of your idea, is that it isn't just a way to help the individuals who've taken on student debt. It's that, and some people have been making this case, all that student debt is actually a drag on the economy. It's hurting everybody else, even if they haven't taken that debt.
Exactly. Why do people seem stuck in their jobs? People aren't moving around. People, you know, for a long time, people hopped jobs more and more every generation, and now they're doing it less. Why? Why are these millennials, you know, stuck in their jobs, highly educated, highly productive millennials stuck in their jobs, and student debt seems to be a big reason.
Some people might make the moral hazard argument. If people took on too much debt that maybe they shouldn't have and it gets paid off now, well, does the next generation look at that and say, okay, well, I'm going to take off too much debt now myself and maybe I'll get the same bailout later on?
Exactly. That's definitely a problem. So the way you deal with that is you switch to income-based repayment for all student loans in the future, which means that you switch to a system where how much people pay back essentially depends on how much money they make. And rare is the person who will say, I'm going to choose to make less money so I don't have to pay back my student loans. You know, almost everyone's going to choose to make more money and pay back more of their student loans. And so that will make the system more fair going forward. But we can't do this for the past, except so Bernie Sanders' student debt cancellation plan just cancels debt across the board. But what Warren's does is it cancels it by income so that it essentially implements income-based repayment retroactively. So that if you don't make a lot of money now, you get your student debt canceled. But if you do make a lot of money now, you get your student debt canceled less. You know, so that's kind of retroactively imposing the income-based system. We should move to that in the future, I think.
I want to touch on a couple of the ideas you make the case for. Fracking and nuclear energy in the energy system. There are people who dislike both of them, fracking for oil and natural gas, nuclear energy. You say we shouldn't be getting rid of them, at least not yet. Make the case there.
Right, not yet. So we need to switch to green energy as fast as we possibly can. Solar and wind. Now, here is the paradox. Switching to those green energy sources takes a lot of energy. You know, it takes vehicles and it takes, you know, labor and it takes electricity to keep the lights on for all kinds of things. And it takes a lot of rebuilding. You know, there's so much energy involved in the energy transition. And if you ban fracking nuclear and send the price of energy much higher before we've actually built out the solar panels and the wind turbines and the smart grids and the battery storage facilities and the electric buses and all that stuff, you know, if you do it too soon, it's going to be really, really expensive to actually build that stuff. And then people are going to get really mad and the economy is going to tank and people are going to say, dang it, let's just bring back fossil fuels. Who cares about climate change? Let's let China solve that instead of us. So we don't want that. That's a bad outcome. And so we need to phase out fracking instead of banning it on day one. You can phase it out as the solar and wind come online. You can shut down fracking things. And the easy way to do that is just to have a tax on it that goes up as the amount of fracking, as the amount of solar goes up. You can have a tax that goes up. As for nuclear, we should, it's too expensive to build new nuclear plants. But the canceling the old nuclear plants would be, you know, very, very bad because it would result in a lot more use of fossil fuels, ironically, including fracking. And, you know, or it would just cut people off of electricity if you didn't want to do that. So just keep the old nuclear plants going till they die, then retire them and then replace them with solar and stuff like that.
And your fifth idea, more H-1B visas. These are non-immigrant visas that allow U.S. companies to bring in usually graduate-level workers, highly specialized technical fields, a lot of things. This gets some criticism. Why do you think we need more of these visas?
Well, so the reason is because those people, those workers, actually help keep the tech industry in the country. So the tech industry is actually reasonably mobile. It can put a lot of its offices and research facilities and blah, blah, blah in India, right? Okay, so suppose we're deciding whether or not to have Indians come and work here in the United States or have United States offices, like companies, put their offices in India. Obviously, we'd rather keep the workers in the United States so that they spend their money locally and they cooperate with local, you know, like native-born American workers, et cetera. And so we want to keep the economic activity here, and H-1B helps us do that. And the overall effect on keeping jobs here in America from having that labor available in America, actually, in the statistics, it actually outweighs the sort of competition effect from H-1Bs competing with native-born people. So then actually having more H-1Bs here actually increases tech jobs for native-born Americans and increases their wages as well, although that might seem counterintuitive to someone who feels like they're competing with Indian workers at work. It actually, that's why there's a place to compete in the first place, is because of the H-1Bs.
Briefly, Noah, as we wrap up, five opinions running against the tide here. Do you have hopes in the election season that anybody will pick up and run with them?
Well, no. I think that nobody wants to run on unpopular positions, but I have hope that there are some candidates who will, you know, understand the rationality of these positions once in office. That's kind of the best we can hope for, because I think on most of these things, it's going to take a long time for people to change their mind. It takes a long time for people to change their mind about anything, whether they're right or wrong. look how long it took us to change our minds about, like, the Vietnam War. Some people never change their minds about that. And so, and even when we get it wrong, it takes too long to change our minds. But then a leader can change their mind and do the right thing, even if it's unpopular, as long as it's not too unpopular.
Noah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Noah Smith, columnist with Bloomberg, formerly assistant professor of finance at Stony Brook University. We talked to him today about a handful of national policies he thinks the U.S. should adopt, even though most people don't like them. Still time to share your thoughts on these issues over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.